to the basic discussion session. And the format will be a bit different from that of last week. So it will start with a short presentation by Cedric Bennett, and he will talk about approximate error correction, which was in some way already introduced in the talk yesterday, where we heard about probably something like non-approximate error correction. So please.
Okay, so yeah, it should be like, I will talk for about 20 minutes, but you can, it's a discussion, right? So you can interrupt me as much as you can, and we can go on a tangent anytime. That's kind of the idea. So I want to, I will introduce kind of two results that are kind of fundamental, and then, you know, there will be, and talk about maybe some applications to physics, or at least I will not really talk about them, but kind of try to direct in that direction. There's of course an application to holography that has been used, and so on Friday there's a session specifically for the application to holography by Shi Dong. So I can mention a few things about this, but maybe this should be, you could think of this as a preparation for that, if that's what you are interested in. So I want to start with defining quantum channels. I think they were not really defined yet. So the best way to think about them is as you have some input system, then you do an isometry into a bigger system. Let's call them A, B, and E. So an isometry is just a map from the Hilbert space of system A that embeds it into the Hilbert space of B and E. So you could think of this as, you know, simply you could just create a pure state that's fixed and then do a unitary. That's an isometry. So it just satisfies this condition. So what is a channel? A channel is what B gets. So the map from, if you put a density matrix as input, and you don't care about that system, then there will be some map that maps it to the reduced state on B, which is a quantum channel. So N would be a quantum channel. So any quantum channels, they are defined more generally. There's the most general map that makes sense on density matrices, but they can all be purified in this way in terms of an isometry. And if you don't care about B, but you care about E, then that's also a channel which is called a complementary channel.
So it's labeled N because people think of it as noise?
Yeah. Well, it will be noise, encoding, decoding, all of them. I will only talk about channels. Everything I will write down is a channel. So this is, in a sense, this is a generalization of what Jonathan talked about, the purification of a state. You can purify a channel into an isometry. So the isometry is a purification or dilation of the channel. And it's unique up to a unitary on an isometry on the environment. So it's unique in the same sense that the purification of a state is unique, and this is kind of the most important property. So half of the result I will explain now essentially come from the fact that this is unique. Just to mention, to relate it with the previous, with the introduction by Zhang Wang. So it means that I can write this as, you know, you do the isometry, and then you trace out the environment, partial trace. You can also write this as, if you expand the partial trace, you can write this as, in terms of sum over operators. And these are what Zhang Wang was calling the errors. If this is your noise that you try to correct. So in exact error correction, we don't really worry about the channel itself, because if you can correct it, what matters is the linear span of the errors. So if any channel which has, where those operators are in the same linear span, can be corrected by the same correction channel. So it doesn't matter in that case. But when we do, when we want to solidify everything, then we need to know kind of what the actual channel is.
Can you explain the uniqueness? I mean, you might think that if you purify and then you take a product with anything else, it's still pure. So.
Yeah, so up to any isometry, extra isometry on the environment. So
the minimalistic thing you can do to.
Well, no, I just take any of them. So just find any of such possible V, and the other ones will be just related to it by a partial isometry on the environment. So essentially unitary. You can always embed it in a bigger space, that's why it's not just unitary, but an isometry. There's kind of a minimal one in a certain sense, but it's not really important.
What are the operators EI again?
So there's another way of expressing those. So if you just expand the partial trace in terms of a basis of the environment, so this is on the environment, this is on B, then these are my EIs. They're called Krauss operators, and they are what you should think as errors, individual errors. Okay, so this is all I want to say about channels. And it's this complementary channel is important. So so basically, one of the conditions that Zhongwen mentioned is essentially saying that if you have a code on A that is correctable for B is not correctable for E, and vice versa. So a code on A is correctable for B if and only if it's not correctable for A. So we kind of generalize this idea with further. So what is called an error correction? So typically expressed in number of channels, even an error channel E, so E for error now, to find an encoding, let me call it V because usually it's just an isometry, and a decoding or recovery operation R. So these are all channels such that if you first encode and then you recover, you should get the identity on the code. So here I'm thinking of this as, you know, going for a small Hilbert space, an abstract Hilbert space, which is your code space, into the physical Hilbert space. Then the error is a physical thing acting on the physical space, and then the recovery can be thought of abstractly as coming back into the code space, that is an abstract small Hilbert space.
So like last time you need to know what the error is or where it is or something about it?
Well, so I'm doing it abstractly. So to know where the error is, there are measurements that will happen inside this channel. So this channel can include measurements, conditional, unitary, based on the output of the measurements. This is all, it's all inside this. Because this is a channel is the most general thing you can do to a quantum system. So it includes measuring whatever you want. So I'm kind of taking the most abstract view because the most abstract view is simpler.
So you're doing this for any possible script E, any possible error.
So imagine that E is kind of fixed by your physics. It is the error that you're trying to fight. To correct against.
That's not part of the problem. You don't know what that is necessarily.
Well, so it so happened that once you solve this problem for some E, the same R and the same V works for a whole class of E's, which are all those with those Krauss operators have the same span. So actually, you don't really need to know a posteriori. It so happens that you don't need to know E exactly.
Yeah, there's two sources of things that you don't know. So one is what you just said, that you don't actually have to know the exact E. But the other is E itself has some uncertainty, right? Because it's a mixture of these different Krauss operators, not exactly a mixture, but you have these different Krauss operators and you don't know which one actually occurred, right? So E could be, there's a probability of X error on the first qubit and Y error on the second qubit, et cetera.
Right, that's what I was imagining.
Yeah. So this takes that part directly into account, that equation. And then there's the additional fact that it works for different units as well.
So for instance, imagine there's a unitary that happens, but you don't know which one, what the class of unitaries, E1, E2, and so on. Then this will be the channel. It's unitary UI happens with priority PI, so. This uncertainty is contained in the definition of E. So E is a quantum stochastic map. It's a random description of how much you don't know of the randomness. So of course there's a, you know, you could say if I don't know exactly which channel I have, then I can also write down the convex combination, and then that's one channel again. I want to talk about kind of, can we characterize this when it's close to the identity? But I want to talk about something a bit more general in that direction. So it's a general question. I mean, we're trying to, there are kind of two different kind of problems. There's two parts to this problem. One part is you have to find both V and R, right? So finding V is building a code, and finding R is checking whether this code is correctable. One of those questions is hard, one is kind of easy. So the hard one is building a code. Checking whether a given code is correctable is kind of a solved problem. But I will talk about generalizing this solved problem. So I will not talk about building codes. So I will think of this as just one map that is given, and then check whether you can find R that inverts it. So it's more called, maybe we should call it channel reversibility, or reversal recoverability, or sufficiency. That's the terminology coming from classical statistics, especially the word that Dennis Petz used. So then the question is just, you know, given N, which could be E in V, does there exist an R such that R composed with N is close to the identity? And we can generalize this and ask whether it's close to another channel N. In fact, we'll see why this can be useful. It's useful if, for instance, if you only care about, you don't want your code to function for any observable, but for a subalgebra of observable, then you take M to be the projector on this algebra. I will say more about this. So that's one kind of problem. And the other problem I want to rapidly summarize is, you can also ask that, that you can invert N on a class of states, on a set of states. That's fixed. So these are actually quite different looking problems in practice, but they are related. So this is an inequality as channel, so it's for all states by definition. Or you can ask that you want to invert N on some specific states.
And that all states means all states in the full Hilbert space of the of A or what?
So N has some input Hilbert space. So if N is this, then this is a code space. And it means any density matrix that you can build on acting as Hilbert space.
I see, but within the code.
Well, so if N includes an encoding into a bigger space, then I just hid it there, right?
So you're taking all states within just the code subspace, or all states?
So when I write this, I mean all states inside the input space of N.
Right.
If you want to talk about a specific code, you can just hide it in the form of N. You say, I first have a fixed map that encodes a small Hilbert space into a bigger one.
Okay.
And then you're talking about every input of N, but effectively you are talking about every state supported on the subspace as input of E.
Okay.
I'm just, it's just a faster way of writing it down, more general. So let me talk about those two problems. So the first one and this one. So if there exists, let me first talk about the exactive. If there exists R such that this is true, I will say that, I will write that N is more informative than M. It's a partial order on channels. It's a nice shorthand. Because if you can just do the same as the channel M by just first doing N and then destroying some extra information with R, then you know N carries more information than M strictly. It's a partial order, it's not a full order. And so this idea that I mentioned that something correctable for B is not correctable for E can be generalized in the sense that N is more informative, kind of more equal, bigger or equal than M if and only if the channel complementary to N is less informative than that complementary to M. So this is, I think, so if you decompress that, for instance, suppose that M is the identity. So this is, it means that you're trying to correct the whole code space, the whole input space of N. Then the complementary channel is equivalent to the trace. So I say the complementary channel is not unique, but you know you can, for what matters, you know, if you say two channels are equivalent if they are both bigger or equal to each other, that's an equivalence relation that says they carry the same information. Then in that sense, the equivalence class of the complementary channel is unique. So I can say about the complementary channel is equivalent to the trace, or any channel that is constant is any channel that carries no information. The trace is the channel from your Hilbert space into the one-dimensional Hilbert space, which has only one state, which is one. Okay. So then this says that if you can correct N exactly, you can correct N exactly if only if the complementary channel gets no, carries no information, because it carries even less information than the trace, which carries nothing.
Trace times density matrix on the environment, right?
No, I mean the trace has a channel. So the trace is a channel that you know take n by n matrices to one by one matrices.
That's one by one density, okay.
Or any constant channel that takes a state and map it and trace it out and maps it to one fixed state. It's the same. They're all equivalent in terms of it carries no information.
Took the fixed state and removed it, made it one by one or something.
You remove it, well, so I could do this in any dimension, it doesn't matter. So in one dimension, the only state is the number one. Okay. So this can be written, this thing can be done. So, you know, this is the same condition that this is equivalent to all the condition. In that case, it's equivalent to all the condition that Zhang Wan was talking about. So it's the Laplacian conditions and so on. And so this can be made epsilonified in the following way. You can try to add some distance measure between R, N, and M, and minimize this distance over R. If you pick the right measure of distance, then this is equal to the dual version. So you minimize over every channel. So this is the epsilonified version of that. It works for, this is equality only for one, for the fidelity, the entanglement, well, for either entanglement fidelity for a given state, or for the worst case entanglement fidelity. But for this to work, the distance has to measure what happens to entanglement. So there has to be a reference system, and you have to measure, it has to be a bad distance if you destroy entanglement with a reference system. So this is kind of one of the reasons why we always need this reference system. If we don't do this, then we get a factor of dimension that talks in.
Could you say what D means?
Yeah, so for instance, for D, so I will take D between two arbitrary channels. Could take D to be a measure of distance made up from the fidelity, so for instance, the arc cosine of the fidelity, but there are other options between. So I'm going to write, for instance, between the fidelity between n tensored with the identity on some pure state. Then it depends on that pure state. And the dimension of the extra space has to be large enough, as large as that of on which n acts. So this is true for this guy.
You maximize over state psi?
So this statement is true for a fixed psi, and it's also true for the worst case. So you can also take the max distance of psi. So this is true for any psi, but this is also true.
So in the case where you have a fixed state, isn't the input range of the two different one? Or this doesn't matter because you just exchange the role between the purification and the actual system.
So the input range of what?
Of the channels. So in one case, it's a channel M, and in the other case, it's
So here N and M have the same input space.
Oh, okay. It's just a complementary output that is relevant.
So the input space of all of those is the same, right?
Okay.
You can also, you know, here I was saying you can hide the code in N as an isometry embedding, but you can also hide the code in the support of the partial trace of psi if you want. That works too. Okay, so, right. So let me give a few examples of what would we like to do with M, for instance. So for instance, you could take, suppose you want to do, you know, correction, but you don't care about being able to, that all observables on the target system have the correct expression value. Maybe you only care about some observables. I will explain this will be useful in if you try to do error correction for gauge theory, for instance. So in that case, you can take M to be a channel which projects on the algebra of observables that you care about. So what do I mean by this? So for instance, if you only care about a subsystem of the output, then you could take the algebra to be the algebra of operators which act trivially on on the subsystem. And then the projector, so in general, this projector is a channel which you can write it as, so it maps any operator to an operator inside the algebra, and it's projective. So for instance, it could be doing the averaging over every unitary inside the commutant of the group. But what it does is that if you plug it anything in, you get something inside the algebra, and it's projective. So if you do it twice, the same as doing once, and in the Hasbeck picture, it's also the same channel. So you could want to do that, or this is like subsystem quantum error correction, but then it works at the approximate level also. You could maybe, you'll want to have a super selection rule, so you don't care about so if you have super selection, then you only care about some observables which are, you know, respect the super selection criterion. So it's going to be diagonal matrices if you in finite dimension, where P is a complete set of projectors. Also, the algebra could represent all local operator in gauge theory. And that is gauge. So what happens in that case to be able to use this, you need to know what the channel complementary to M is. So if M is a projector on an algebra, then the channel complementary is a projector on the commutant of the algebra. So the set of all operators that commute with your operator in A. So this was used in a paper by Shidong. Okay. Also, you might worry whether maybe you try to only correct classical information, and then you might take the algebra to be a commutative algebra. Maybe to make this a bit more concrete, let me rapidly mention an example of where maybe that's not useful. Okay. I'll stop there for this thing. I also want to... Oh, I already passed my 20 minutes, I guess. So let me rapidly... Sorry for that. Let me just rapidly mention one result in terms of... for this question. So this is something that people... That's pretty recent. So if you have a relative entropy between two states and you have a channel, so in general, if you apply the channel, then the relative entropy decreases because things become less distinguishable. And there's a celebrated result, which is that this is positive. This is equivalent to the strong superadditivity of relative entropy. And so people have proven that actually they can put something larger than zero here, which is, I think, correct me if I make a mistake, 2 log of the fidelity between R and sigma. So this is where it connects to kind of channel reversal. And here R is a map that correct and exactly on rho. So rho is contained in the definition of R. So if you map that inverts n exactly, and you ask how much you can invert n on some other state, then this is bounded by by a loss of distinguishability between the two states. So there's a connection between inverting a map and a loss of distinguishability. You can relate this to that measure if you want. You can just make this act on a subsystem. The form of R is known, so if N acts only on a subsystem, then also R acts on a subsystem, so then you can get also use this same condition. Okay, so that's all the technical thing I wanted to introduce. So, how does this go from here?
So, maybe, I guess, to me it would be interesting to elaborate physically the meaning of the formula, very elegant formula with the N and the M. So, my starting point is that the N of rho, the thing that the resulting output of the channel N, is basically the state from which you can get information, while the complementary channel acting on rho is sort of physically what the environment sees. Okay, so that physical picture seems useful. I was wondering, so for example, if M is identity, so N is identity, then you just get the state. The channel is trivial, N is trivial, and you just get the state, and the environment doesn't get anything. It just gets the trace, but the trace of all densities is 1, so it doesn't get anything. Could you elaborate in that picture the more complicated formula with the N and M?
Yeah, so, well, I can elaborate at least. When M is projectable in algebra, I can say something. So it says that in the same statement where suppose you you also put in some code here, but when you've corrected, you do not really want to have exactly the same state necessarily. because you're only going to measure a certain subclass of observables. And so two different states might give you the same expectation values for all of those observables. So then if you get here maybe the wrong state, but a state that gives you the same expectation value, then you don't care about it. So it's a less stringent requirement, right? You only require things to be true for the class of to get the same expectation value for this given class of observables inside the algebra. So then the statement says that essentially, but then I can talk about correcting for an observable. So we can correct for an observable on A, or a class, an algebra of observable on B, if and only if E can only learn about the commutant of this class of observables. So what it means is that the observables that both B and E can learn about are in the center, so they commute. So it's a no-cloning theorem, again, that if you want both B and E to be able to learn about the same observables, then this class of observables must be commuting. They can only jointly know classical information about the Orion system.
If you take the same observable for E and B, then by definition they commute.
No, I mean, I'm talking about sets of observables. So yeah, so it's true. So if you only worry about one observables, then the algebra is just the algebra generated by. Okay, I didn't say that, but I think in this context, this algebra has to contain the identity. So if you only care about one observables, then you care about the algebra that is spanned by one and the observable. And then the commutant is itself, because it's a commutative algebra. For general M, it's a bit trickier to think about. So of course now we can still ask questions about this, but also some of these results have been applied to various physical questions. So maybe I can just rapidly mention some of the questions that they have been applied to, and maybe the audience has more examples of because quantum error correction is an engineering problem. It's not physics really. Right? Physics come in to solve the engineering problem. So why would why should a physicist care about this? So the way I like to think about it, but there are other applications, of course, is inference. Really. So in physics, we typically, we don't get full information about the physical world. We always get partial information. We can only measure large scale things. We cannot measure Planck length observables. So you might think of this channel N that is fixed as going, say, from the true quantum system, whatever it is, to what you can actually observe in practice. For instance, it could be renormalization. It could be a coarse graining map that maps the microscopic physics to the macrophysics that you can actually observe. And then the task of a physicist, so we don't know what this is, but when you do physics, you have access to this system, and you're trying to infer something about the macroscopic system. So then, from this point of view, when you ask whether, you can recover a state, you're asking whether you can infer this state from the output of N. So here, R does the inference. But this is statistics, it's not really physics. One question I've been wondering about is whether the form, we know that in quantum field theory, most quantum field theories are effective. So they're not really, we don't really believe that they describe the true system. We believe that they describe what we see. So the question is, can we use information theory and the solutions to these type of questions to see if we are doing this right? It is not a better way of trying to infer what the macroscopic model is from the data. Also, another question is, we build all these theories, so to what extent, which aspect of the theories we have actually connects to the system at hand, or do they are just artifacts of of whatever inference or the lack of information we have.
My understanding of this is there are statements about the optimal way to do things, like the Cramer's row bound and so on. Do you have in mind something that overlaps with that or something different?
Yeah, so, this is part of the question. Yes. So the Cramer row bound is about distinguishability. We can formulate it in terms of distinguishability, so it connects to this in some sense. It's a kind of a perturbative version of this when the two states are very close to each other. So to say more, this channel here, okay, well not this one specifically, but one on which, well, at least, well, the channel you get for the, there was a result prior to this, which was when this is equal to zero, then you can exactly correct both sigma and rho, and the channel that does this is a Petz transpose map. And in the classical level, this map is exactly the Bayesian inference map. So this is, in some sense, the equanimous version of Bayesian inference. So it's contained in there, where this state rho is a prior, and n at the classical level is a set of conditional probability distributions, which is what you are inverting using Bayesian inference. So this is a kind of a quantum generalization of Turing inference. Okay, so this is just one idea. Of course, quantum reconstruction has been used to understand topological phases. So this is something I really don't. That I don't know much about. So, but there are knowledgeable people in the audience. That might be want to say something about this and whether approximate quantum recursion can make improvements on this. There's also so it's been used in holography recently, but we will have a session about this on Friday. I want to say though that in the holographic context, it does relate to the idea of deriving an effective model. But it's used in quite a different way than what I had in mind. So we can talk about this also. Of course, there are many other questions that there's a whole bunch of questions in approximate quantum error question, which is which result of exact error questions can be carried over to the approximate context. Some people mentioned some of those questions in the question session. There was a question of, for instance, reference. Well, quantum error correction in a case where there are reference frames, where the reference frame is missing. So, if there's some physical constraints, there's also the logical operator avoidance, which is not something I know anything about at this point, and. This could be used to do error correction in gauge theory. And there are much more basic questions, which are like something. It's very important in quantum error correction that we don't need that they hold a large class of channels that are corrected by the same correction channel. So, how does this generalize to the approximate setting? I don't know what's known about this. Do you want to write it down? No, I don't know if it's very limiting. It's you start from the Petz map. So let me write the Petz transpose map. So if you apply to see sigma, what it does is it divides by the square root of the image of rho. Then apply n dagger, and then so this one is already pretty good. First of all, it does this at the classical level, I think. Also, it does this when we get equality here, so it does invert exactly. But for this bound, this has to be modified. It's there's an integral with unitary twirling on both sides in and out over some complicated function. That's the extent of my knowledge.
Well, if sigma equals rho, then it recovers it exactly. Right?
Yeah, so this is a map
that's
which
why it's cool.
Which is built so that it's a map which is built so that it reverts n exactly on the rho, but this is not difficult because you could just take our rho to be to just trace out sigma and replace it by rho. But this one does this in kind of the lightest possible way, in a way that preserves as much information about the input. Right? This one destroys everything about the input, but this one kind of, in some sense, preserves as much as possible about the input while still recovering rho.
And nearby states next to rho will be.
Yeah. In fact, in the exact setting, one can characterize a set of all states which can be, on which n can be inverted together with rho, and therefore some kind of algebra. And R, and this map corrects all of them.
Sigma doesn't necessarily need to be near to rho, so that's additional condition that it also corrects sigma is exactly the reason why the trivial solution that Sayegh-Grothendieck doesn't work. So in some way, the condition like this big inequality ensures that essentially what you said in words, that the channel should preserve as much information as possible. And formally, this means that whenever you apply to some sigma, it should have that behavior, whatever sigma is. Even if sigma is an arbitrary difference, then
so they don't have to be.
Formula somehow captures exactly that fact that you said the map is maximally informative about the input.
Yeah, so the question is not that it is close to rho, is that. The distinguish it does not lose distinguishability with to rho when you apply n.
Because this map that you wrote down would exactly destroy all distinguishability. You would always output rho even if you input sigma. So the second expression would essentially be zero. So the difference would be maximally large.
Unless sigma is close to rho, then the one that there is.
Still maximum.
Yeah.
So what's the intuition for that 1 over square root? I think I forgot it.
Intuition.
Plug in n of rho and it'll cancel out the n of rho.
I get it cancels, but... From the quantum error correcting perspective,
Does someone have an intuition for?
Maybe I think the best way to see the intuition is to actually do what you wrote in the classical case. So if you write down the distributions of this Bayesian integral, then it will actually this thing will appear as kind of a probability by which you divide, which is there in the Bayes formula.
So here's the intuition, right? When you do Bayesian inference, you're just inverting the two arguments of the conditional probability distribution, which is the dagger here. But the n-dagger map is not trace preserving. It's not a map. It's not trace preserving. So this kind of just renormalize it to make it trace preserving. So in Bayesian inference, that's when you divide by to make it to renormalize the transpose, which is not a probability distribution. Well, it's not for. It works for every state.
In other words, the rho depends on how far it depends on rho. So
in that context, think of rho as kind of this Bayesian prior. So it does not work only for rho. It works for all state satisfying this. So you're saying, you know, rho, I want to be able to invert and on rho for sure, and then what else can I invert it on? Or, for, yeah.
Special case which may help to get some intuition. I think this very general case is kind of hard to understand if one sees it for the first time. So a special case is actually the case you considered yesterday where you just lose a subsystem. And where the map is just one where you trace over one subsystem. And then the formulas, I mean, I don't know whether it's even possible to even write them down, but they're in some way more intuitive. And there you see that if you write them down in this special case, then the recovery map doesn't actually depend on the the parts it shouldn't depend. So, I mean, it's true that originally the result was such that one only knew that there is some recovery map for every state. But this explicit recovery map in this case where you trace over the system will be essentially state independent. To the extent it can be, of course, it still has to somehow depend on those parts. I mean, it needs the information what should be recovered, but it doesn't depend on what corresponds to the input channels. Yes, maybe we look at the formula in the special case and then discuss that part.
Are you getting exact results here? Meaning, you're inferring something. I've understood you've gotten rid of part of the system and you're keeping track of what you actually observe, and you're doing the best you can with that. So, in the more familiar version of inference, you end up with an error bar on your parameter. And you try and optimize that, make it as small as you can. You're sort of saying you recover it exactly.
No, so there's a point of kind of putting bound on it. So this is, you know, in that context, for instance, this is how well you can do it, and you can use this to build bound that you can actually compute.
So when you say you recover it, and you get rho back or something here.
No, so in that context, there exists a channel or rho, which recover rho exactly. But that's fine because that's not useful. We know what rho is. Rho is just one fixed state. What's useful is that even if the state is a bit is different from rho, it still works, but not exactly. And this is how well it works. So think of rho as your vacuum state. You know everything about it, and now you care about perturbations around it and non-trivial things.
So there's an infinite number of parameters there that you're trying to bound.
All of this is proven in finite dimension, but there are ways to go to infinite dimension, probably. I mean, surely, you know, n destroys information, so you cannot hope to recover everything about input. But the question might be, what kind of thing you can recover and under what conditions. And there are trade-offs to be made. So for example, in Bayesian inference, the trade-off is you kind of have to input a prior by hand, and what you will deduce will depend on the prior.
You could do frequentist statistics, right? is there a Fisher matrix at all up here?
Yeah, so actually, you can have before I answer, should I finish writing?
I'm curious about this example.
Let me finish writing this, and then I will explain how this connects to the Fisher metric.
What is the rho that you take in this case?
So I take an arbitrary rho on a Babbitt system, rho AB, and then the channel is just partial trace of a B, So n of rho AB is this rho A. The n dagger, so the channel, the Hilbert-Schmidt dual tensors input with the identity on B. So then what this is just 1 over square root of rho A. A then tensored with the identity on B. And square root of rho AB. Is this illuminating?
I just want to point out special case of your example. If you and link this to thermodynamics, if you take rho to be the Gibbs state, then the recovery map, and you trace out, say, the bath, then the recovery map basically assigns a Gibbs state to the bath. So it's just saying that, you know, they should. If you don't have access to the thermal bath, you can kind of recover its state by just assigning a Gibbs state to the bath. If it's like non-interacting with your system or weak. Well, take rho AB to be the Gibbs state, the joint, like the Gibbs state of the system in the bath, so they're in the product state. Right? And it's a trivial example, right? But it's
so it might be tensor of two Gibbs, not a thermal field double.
No, okay. I'm not talking about thermal field double. There's like a system in the bath, the system is in some Gibbs states at the same temperature as the bath. That's the state rho, right? And then you take the map that it traces out the bath. So you only have access to the system. Right? Well, the recovery map that corresponds to forgetting the bath is one that assigns the Gibbs state to the bath. Kind of inferring the state of the bath as being the Gibbs state.
So what point were you making about form?
So in this particular case, the channel traces out A1 could now, let's say, I don't know what you meant exactly, but it's state depends, but originally the results were of the form that one would say, if you now take this map R and you want to minimize this, or you want to satisfy this condition, then this depends on actually the full state, including the purification that we put. Whereas here, by this explicit map, you see that the purification, there is no dependence on the purification. Now, this means that if you, for example, think of this rho AB as itself like just a in some way, Joya-Wilkowski representation of a channel from, let's say, B to A, then the recovery map only depends on that channel. That's roughly the idea. But, let's say that the important thing is that this formula, this R, doesn't depend on an additional system, on purification. But it still works for any purification or for any additional system. So if you input now a state rho ABE, there's some arbitrary E, it will always minimize the distance independently of what this E system is.
Well, I see one relevant case for this formula works perfectly, where you're correct by looking at map the full. Because you lose some part of your system, I suppose you can fill that hole by looking at some neighborhood of that, but not the entire system.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In that case, and a condition on that, every probe state has an independent patch that includes the neighbor of that missing hole. In that case, that recovery map perfectly works as a correction. More general case where you have to access the full system and it does not function as a correct.
Yes, I agree with that comment. Yes, that's also what I see.
So let me answer where you can see the Fisher information matrix. So if you are looking at the relative entropy functions between two nearby density matrices. So imagine F is a small number, and X is a perturbation of the state rule. Then to lowest order in epsilon, you get a bilinear form, the norm of X in a bilinear form that depends on rho, and this is a Fisher information metric. There's a whole class of them, that's one specific one, but you can make a similar statement for any, which is kind of trivial to prove, which is linear algebra, for any Fisher information metric. So then it's about, then you should think of rho as the base point. So you're looking, you're on the manifold of the same matrices, and you're looking at tangent vectors at the point rho. And then you can make a statement about, inverting a channel on that in a way that that does not. So well. So if your tangent vectors don't lose too much distinguishability, don't decrease too much under the action of the channel, then you can invert the channel on these tangent vectors. So Fisher information metric characterizes distinguishability by just in a differentiated form.
Right.
Just like S does.
So is the quantum version stronger or weaker than the classical version of this kind of thing, or is that
probably
being a question?
Well, it's just as good in that case. Well, I think in the classical case we can put the relative entropy here. So the classical result is cleaner because here we lose something when you go from this nice measure of distinguishability, this is the relative entropy, to one that has kind of less direct operational interpretation, that is the fidelity. But classically, one can put instead here, is it relative entropy? Is it just this, or is it the other way around? I'm not sure.
I think it's the other way.
Yeah, because the more noisy one is. But so maybe that's a bit stronger.
Maybe just to complete the answer to this question, classically what we show an equality in this case. So for the base, so the base map, which is in this case exactly this Hetz recovery map that is written down there in the classical case. And is the best one and gives exactly that difference. Now, in the quantum case, one would hope that one has a similar result, because let's say this fidelity, the log fidelity, can always be written also as a relative entropy, but it's a Rényi relative entropy of order 1/2, which is always smaller than this relative entropy S. So it's a weaker result in that sense. So one would hope that one could strengthen that result and get the same result as in the classical case. However, as far as I remember, there was a recent example, I think by Omar Fassi, someone else, by Gazim, his brother, who gave an example where this is actually violated. So it cannot be true. So this equality that holds in the classical case cannot be true in the quantum case.
I wonder, it's maybe totally off, but I wonder if the reason is there's more correlations and so forth, so fewer independent experiments in essence.
So if you
fewer
independent
experiments. Certain things are more correlated,
You have just more. The quantum case includes, of course, the classical
right.
set, but you have more. I think. I mean, personally, I don't have an intuition why this is not true in the quantum case, or why these examples work that show that it's not the case. But.
Does
the limit of what you can measure enter into this? It's a little bit different. No, I don't think so.
Wait, sorry. I
don't.
I mean, I was thinking of the Fisher matrix as giving you
an
estimate for the error bars. So. Yeah, so it doesn't sound like it's quite there.
So I'm not sure I understood the question.
What was. I mean, in order for the explanation to be that somehow in the quantum setting you're more limited because there's sort of less of independent stuff that you can measure because things are more correlated or something.
Yeah, I mean, even with classical probability distributions, that
can happen that can produce.
But it sounds like that's not entering into that.
And measurements don't enter in this one, because these relative entropies really relate directly to quantum state. So it's not that probability distribution that arises from measurements.
But it's, well, but it's an uncertainty, right? I mean,
yes, but the uncertainties are kind of calculated directly for the states independently of how you access information on the states.
I agree, it's a theoretical.
Yes. I mean, they have some operational means, but it's not involving measurements. So the fact that we cannot get information about the state by a single measurement doesn't enter that.
I don't think we're disagreeing. I don't think there's a contradiction.
Maybe I should put this in a more familiar form, because people have been looking at it, where the noise is just freezing out the system. So in that context, one might want to look at replacing sigma by a state on three systems, and then rho on being the version without the correlations between A, B, and C. When you do something like this, you are measuring the mutual information between A and C. And then this being positive is just saying that, how does it work? I'm probably going to make a mistake. So it's going to be did I get it wrong? I always forget. Yeah, so there's a nice formation of this in terms of just this special case where you're just removing one system and you are measuring how correlations are modified. So how much correlation between A and B is mediated by system B. Maybe I should write it in mutual information. So it's is that then this is the feasibility of how much one can recover the missing system.
How does one view coarse graining system or having just limited amount of information we can access about it to the version of the quantum error correction? I mean, say, like what we heard yesterday, that okay, you want to read of the information in a state of a single qubit, and you can do this encoding by 9 qubits or something, so that you can, if that gets corrupted, you still have access to the full set of information. But I'm having a hard time mapping that to the physicist more familiar system, that setting that you have some full quantum system and you really have access to some part of it, or some coarse graining going.
Yeah, so I was more thinking in the context where there's no real encoding and is it's kind of given by the and just from your lack of information about the system. But you can also imagine that you want your effective theory to work only for low energy states, for instance, and then you encode your code will be some low energy subspace.
But there is some unspoken sort of goal in this that seems to be differing between what or a drink yesterday and this. I mean, before we were trying to just read up an information of the smoke of, say, the one cubic state, right? Whereas here, we're sort of, it almost sounds like you're trying to take the smaller system and somehow infer what the full, richer, larger quantum system looks like, or something like that. It doesn't, I mean, it sounds like a different set of things you want to do with it.
Yeah, so I don't know if this question really connects to what I was saying in the way that the way these results were used in holography is actually not matching this picture.
I'm not worried about holography for
you. No, but
that's additional complication. Let's just talk about, I don't know, we have a some system in nature, some quantum system, but you only know, some corresponding corridor, what have you. I mean, the examples that you specified when you started talking about inference. But that setup still, I don't know how to match on to the quantum error correcting codes, the job that those things are supposed to be doing.
Okay. I think it's very closely related to what we heard yesterday. I think it's just in some way, an extended approximate version of that. I don't know, if you don't mind, I can briefly write down what I had in mind. But so, if I understand your question correctly, it's kind of the question, how can we think of what we heard yesterday in his talk in these terms?
Mm-hmm.
And I hope you don't mind if I...
I don't know if you want the microphone.
No, I don't think I need it. It's just very short, but it's very... So maybe I could just... to make that connection, briefly write down this formula in the special, I mean, you already almost wrote it down in the special case, but just that we have it in one picture. So there is this difference between mutual informations. This thing, and this can also be written in a different way. So there is this notion of a condition or conditional mutual information, which is essentially, I mean, if you look at this, if this difference here is zero, this means that it doesn't help you to have B if you want to say something about C. That's more or less. And that now, if you look at the case of a system E, I could also look at this thing, like how much information does a system E, which someone could now think of E as, for example, information I actually want to encode. And okay. A, so the picture one could have in mind is like there is a system A which I will lose, so this will be lost. There is a system, I think it was A in your case that was lost in your notation.
Yeah.
And B is the rest of the code that we keep. So that's kept. And then there is some E, which is, I think you mentioned that yesterday, in some way a reference system. One could even think of E as this is actually the information you want to encode, and it's encoded here in this thing, and you lose a part of this code word. So that's so the way I think of E. So this is what you want to store, and the code, and technically it's just a purification of what you have here, but it's actually information you want to store, and it's somehow, so E is correlated to this, say, to the code word. And now the question is, what happens if you lose parts of the code word?
Right, so when we were talking about sort of bringing systems in physics into this framework, or rather applying this framework to the systems in physics, I was wondering, so how do you specify an example with of some physical system, let's say a box of gas or something?
Mm-hmm.
What is E, B, and A in the phrasing that you wanted to sort of tie on this, is
okay.
just to get a a mental anchor.
Yes.
Maybe
then I could take up the example that you probably made just before in some. So if I let's say if I have a big system, let's say a many body system, and now then I let's say I have here the individual parts of the system, or let's even say it's one-dimensional for simplicity. Now, let's suppose that I have some knowledge about the system, namely that it's kind of local in some way. And local would mean that, or I would hope in some way that it's local, would mean that if I want to generate, let's say I know the state of this part, and I want to know what is the state of the, or I want to recall, let's say this is the state row, let's call this S1 to Sn, to S1 to Sn, and now let's suppose I want to actually know the state S1 to Sn plus 1, so I want to extend my description. Then I can extend this description in some way without taking into account these things. I only need Sn, so I need a map. So to get from here to here, what I would hope to have in some way, what would be nice to have, would be if I could get from here with a map, and let's say recovery map in some way, that takes only S, that only acts non-trivial Sn and generates Sn plus 1. So technically the map still has to output also Sn because it shouldn't destroy it. So that's just something we would like to have as a thing. So I think some many part system, if we would have an efficient representation of the system because we could essentially build up the state sequentially. So the representation of the system would only take linear space because we would only need to store these maps, which are all small maps. And now, okay, this is just now a completely different example of something we would like to do.
Okay, so in the language of the qubits being encoded in some larger set of them, that problem would be mapped to saying that.
So maybe this is now just generically the problem of how do we even in information theory think about an efficient, so we could ask the question, if you have a very large system, under which conditions is it possible for us to describe the system in an efficient manner, in the sense that we don't need an exponentially large description. And this now relates to these discussions because we could think of a description of the system as a sequence of recovery maps in some way, where we kind of would first only start with, let's say, a description of this state, and then we would recreate the system of two states and then more and more. So that's an example where one can use recovery maps.
Maybe I can even link this picture to the idea of small and large, precisely.
But so far, it's not. There is no error, quantum error.
No, there's no error now. This was just a starting point because we want to talk about something, some specific problem we may have. So the specific problem is here, how can we efficiently describe an n-body system, or under which conditions can we efficiently describe it? So that's the possible problem we have, or a typical problem we actually have.
But in here
is also a criterion, when is this possible? So under which conditions do I have such a description? Which is now currently to the question, under which conditions do I have recovery maps that recover this whole sequence of now, okay, maybe the important thing is that in general we couldn't expect this to work because the system has generally an exponentially large size or description size, and this would be now linear because these maps have, so if I assume that these are just qubits, this map is just a map from one qubit to two qubits, so it's a very small object, and it would just need n such objects to recreate the whole state. But sometimes we are lucky and we can do such things. So maybe if you choose these individual systems sufficiently large, that's approximately possible.
So for example, if you knew the system was homogeneous, then you can take any chunk of it and tell what the rest of it.
I mean, intuitively, if there's no long-range entanglement or correlation, this should be possible in some way. But now the point is that this is never perfectly the case. And so that's why I'm interested in approximate recovery. So another way connect that to error correction is the following. I could now think of the problem here of one step as saying, let's suppose I have that larger step, and for some reason I lose the last part. How well can I now recover that part? So this now makes a connection to error correction. So I could think of this problem really as in kind of this reverse order. I'm given the state, and now I lose all these parts, and now I sequentially want to regenerate them. So that's why it's not, that's a, an example where somehow error-correcting ideas enter into just the question of how efficiently can we describe systems. Because I could really just start dropping information and see how well I can recreate. And now this formula here, in this special case, gives you actually a condition when this is possible. This condition is very intuitive. And let me write it down. So let's say the general formula, the general formula in the special case where we look at these maps. So now this map will be the relevant one where we just trace out a part of a system. Now if I take this picture, I trace out A and I keep B and I have some reference E. Would then tell us that, so there's this distance vector 2, F, just to have the same convention, I think you have a factor of 2, yes, log F of rho A, E, and so you look at the distance between the recovered thing, the original thing, and the recovered thing. That is, recovery map generates A from B and doesn't do anything on B. So it somehow acts like the identity on E, but it takes as input the state B. So that's the picture everyone should have in mind here. Maybe the following. So I just draw the same thing I have here. So we have A, B, and E. Now for some reason I lose A, so this gets bin, so I don't have it any longer. I still have B and E, and the recovery map R acts on B and recovers A from B and doesn't do anything on E. But the system E is still here because I want to check whether all correlations that exist between A and E are preserved. So that's why I draw this. But the map doesn't look at the system E. And it's important that this map will also not depend on the state on E. That's what I meant before. Now, what are these systems here? So I could now say in each particular step, so for example, in this step I considered here, this would be the system E, because I don't want to act on this. So that's an example of a system. It's just the rest on which I don't act. Then this thing would be the system B, and Sn plus 1 would be the system A. Does he want to somehow recover A from B, but stay in the correct way correlated to the whole rest, which is E? So that's now an example of these systems could be. And now you see what this thing tells you is something quite intuitive, because what we are, the recovery map is doing well if this expression, if this fidelity is almost 1, so if the right-hand side is almost 0. So we want this mutual information here to be 0, or close to 0. And this is the case now whenever even B, there is so conditioned, so what this thing here tells you, I don't know whether people are familiar with this expression, but intuitively that's how much information does A give you about E if you already know B. So this is exactly this intuition that there is no long-range correlation, because it tells you that if you already have access to B, there is nothing you can learn about E if you also learn CA. So it's essentially this condition, or you could even say the special case where this is zero, this is what people call a Markov chain condition. Then it means that there's a Markov chain from E BA, so in some way, if you generate, so E and A are independent conditioned on B. That's the case where it's exactly zero. So this measure just generalizes the Markov chain idea, makes it quantitative. As long as it's small, it's almost the Markov chain. And so this whole thing now tells you that we have now an entropy-based criterion to answer the question, under which conditions is it possible to describe a system efficiently. So that's just one application where we probably have.
So what was, good.
Okay,
so that I understand. Okay, good. So that. So and now, what is the thing that you are referring to?
Yeah. So it's a very good example, because I can relate it to this. So, so here the error is you trace out some system, but what's important is that because of this, any time you lose information in quantary can be mapped to tracing at something. So this is kind of a generic thing.
For example, the microscopics.
Exactly. So you could imagine this as scale instead of instead of space. And more concretely, I can design any map that somehow arrays small scale information, even in a way that there are many ways to do this. With a scale up to scale lambda, and then what you can do is you can so you can write you can make a sequence of map which is a semi-group. So you erase some information between URs. Imagine N erases some information. Then you can use the same N and erase more information and so on. So then you can have, if you want, N lambda, which is N to a power log of the scale that you've erased. And then you can do the deletion of each of those n, and then you can interpret the so imagine that it's just one step. So this is a state, the microscopic state. This is a state that has been coarse-grained a little bit, and so you're asking, what is this? This is all the information that it is the information of that scale. It is the information that is missing once you've erased the small scale information. So it is one slice of scale. So in momentum, it would be an interval in momentum space, if you want to interpret the momentum. And then as you keep doing coarse graining more and more, you can delete every channel. And what you get is a chain of a state of a many-body system, where each information you get here is of different scales. So you take a microscopic system and you've decomposed it scale by scale. Mm-hmm. And this decomposition is just starting from this N that might be a description of not of anything physical, but of your lack of information. But what you define by scale, meaning the precision of your instrument, right? So you it's something purely information theoretical, and then you decompose it in scale. And then you can ask various questions. You can ask, if I trace out those, so I don't know the small scale information, can I reconstruct smaller scale?
Right, so usually we don't, right? I mean, that's
it. Well, so
expect to.
Let me see how I think about MERA, for instance, in that context. So suppose you want to make you have a microscopic model, a spin system, and you want to know if it matches your large long-range quantum field theory. You might ask, well, no, you put it differently. Suppose you want to make a model of a small scale. You propose a microscopic Hamiltonian, and
I mean, presumably there's many microscopic states that would lead to the same coarse-grained description. If you only have the coarse grain description, you wouldn't expect to flow backwards.
But then you ask the question, this microscopic description, is it compatible with this given microscopic Hamilton? Then you have to fill in, to compare it, to see if it really minimizes the energy of this Hamiltonian. You have to somehow fill in the details to compare it. So then you might ask, can I reconstruct what's missing on all of those steps to be able then to get a microscopic state and compare it to my microscopic Hamiltonian. So you can think of, so here's a question I have, sorry, a concrete question. Suppose I fixed N somehow, because that's what defines my large scale. Then if somehow you can find a correction channel that inverts that, let's say, Well, so I take some fixed state rule, so, and I want R to invert and unroll, but I put a constraint on R. So, you know, it's easy because R might depend on rho, so I can just take this one or just trace out the information. But I might want, if that's a state of a many-body system, I might want to have a constraint that R is local. So that is, it's a local circuit in space. So if I can find a local invert of this coarse graining that recovers my many-body states, then I pretend that I can then, if I do this at every layer, I can build a mirror which reconstructs the state. The locality, if it's defined properly, will mean that the composition of this map forms a circuit which has the same property of mirror, and therefore forms an efficient description of my specific microscopic state.
So in practice, I mean, I guess it goes back to Eva's, I mean, similar question as Eva's thing about the observables. We observe some system, we have some range of data about it with some uncertainty. Now, are you saying that we can somehow learn more about the microscopies that we didn't directly observe by postulating some, you know, map with specific properties that allow us to invert this coarse graining that limited our observation in the first place, or?
Well, I don't know. What I have in mind maybe is more about using the fact that we don't care about all observables in order to compress the description of the theory. So it's more, it's closer to what Renato was saying. But,
I'm confused about this condition here. So I would have thought that the condition for their condition for the recovery of the purification of E just from B would be that the mutual information between A and E is zero, right? Not this conditional mutual information.
The distinction is here we're speaking of, it's a statement about a single state or class of state that satisfies the same quality. Whereas the yesterday's condition where you had the mutual information between A and E are zero, that's for that comes with a qualifier that for every state in the Yerkes space, the mutual information must be zero. Mm-hmm. In that case, the reductance matrix on A turns out to be a constant and their E system recovery map.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that, isn't that a stronger statement than this, though?
It's independent.
Okay. So actually, the conditional mutual information between A and E, given B, and just the mutual information between A and E, can be related in both directions. Mm-hmm. So neither of them is always larger than the other. But maybe the way I think
this, I thought that we were supposed to think about this as giving us the condition. You were saying that you like to think about E as being, it's the purification of the information that you're trying to get, right?
Well, I mean, here it's not necessarily a purification, it's just some, let's say, extension of the state. It doesn't need to be pure. And this is actually, for examples like that one, this is even important, because it could be much harder. So, you see, E is here just the systems on the left. And the purification could consist of all systems, like all parts. Now, because in this particular case, we only need, at the end, the description of the state of these systems and not of the whole rest, we have actually a weaker condition. So, of course, it's easier to recover if E is not a purification, but something mixed. So this condition here takes into account that E may not be a purification. Actually, in the special case where E is a purification, this is less, what is it that one can actually show that
this is equivalent just to AE without the conditioning on B. Mm-hmm. This is just the same, but only the special case where mm-hmm. E, where total state rho AE is pure.
Mm-hmm. Total state rho ABE is pure.
Yes. Mm-hmm. In that case, the two conditions are equivalent.
Okay.
Well, not quite. Because this inequality will tell you in the equality case when the global state is pure, that there exists a recovery map for that particular state. Okay. In the current correction setting, we are given with the multitude of states as that form of space, and for each of them, we should have mutual information zero. In that case, we can find a universal recovery map that works for all states.
I thought by making E big enough, you could sort of put all of the cases you care about in the entanglement with E.
But it doesn't mean that the purified states are all equal.
I think in the finite dimensional case, you could just look at the mix. Like, if you take an input state to the chart, which is kind of covering the whole range of inputs, that should, in principle, be sufficient. Which is probably just a different way of saying what he said, that by having enough additional, let's say, degrees of freedom there. I mean, you could always think of just taking different input states and remember what the input state I've chosen in the environment. Mm-hmm. I think that's what you have in mind. And then take the mixture of all those. And as long as I'm not interested in a quantitative statement, just in the exact statement, this shouldn't matter. Of course, if I'm interested in a quantitative statement, the whole thing will probably be divided by the number of, by the dimension or something like that. Maybe what I'm saying is maybe just the Choi-Yang-Yokosky representation of a channel gives a full description of the channel. And so this is just a particular input, which has to be as mixed as possible on the input domain. But then I have the full description of the channel. So it shouldn't.
Also, there's a link between the entanglement fidelity for a maximally entangled state and the average, for a state of a full support on a subspace and the average, actually for any states, and some kind of average fidelity.
I think I'm totally happy though. There's just a fact, I guess, I don't know. Is it true that if APE is pure, that conditional mutual information is just a mutual information between
A
and E?
Yes. Okay. I think so. Maybe I can check, because there's maybe one way to see it. Probably, let's check. I mean, if I write this out, so that by definition, this is h of a given b minus h of a given b. And now, if a is pure, then this is just equal to h of a, including the minus sign. This is. This is equal to minus h of a given e. Just say why. Mm-hmm. But if that would then be, so this whole thing would then be the mutual information between a and e. Mm-hmm. So now, I don't know if it's clear why this is true, but I can quickly write it down. So h of a given b is equal to h of a e minus h of e. And now, if the state is pure, I can always take the other part of, like, the complement of the system.
And
so that's why I have here this equation. Mm-hmm. So, yes, so the answer is yes.
So it's the conditional mutual information is like the difference between the two sides of strong subadditivity, whereas the mutual information is like the difference between the two sides of subadditivity.
Yes, that's one way to see it. Yes, yes.
Intersection part is trivial than the two are the same.
Yes, yes. But in this particular case, I really prefer to think of the conditional mutual information, because that
really corresponds to this Markov chain condition, mm-hmm. which I think is intuitively the reason why we can construct sequentially. Mm-hmm. So, another division.
I guess
thank you for the presentation. I mean, we can do that, of course, I hope in the special case, where the condition between f is zero, it's kind of intuitively clear that at least in this example, the Markov chain condition is a useful way to think mm-hmm. about that. That's why I prefer that view. And in the case where it's not pure, then it's anyway no longer true. It replaces in this formula this mutual information by just a mutual information between A and B without conditioning on B. Mm-hmm. So a very simple example, by the way, is when, let's say, these are just classical speeds, which are with probability 1/2 all up and with probability 1/2 all down. Then, of course, the mutual information between any two of them is 1, but the conditional mutual information between any two of them conditioned on a third one is 0. Mm-hmm. That's exactly mm-hmm. the relevant thing. Mm-hmm. What will be discussed on Friday?
I guess it's not there's so much that would be influenced.
There are many things to that we can discuss. I was going to just introduce the basics of quantum error correction and ABS-EFT.
That's cool.
And if any of you want to have some time to speak, plan something.
I think it's now a good plan to now apply all that to ABS.
Has this formula been used in? Not better game talking about something relations.
Oh yeah, there. Well, do you mean there is some specific recovering method, maybe related to R well over there, with mm-hmm. the square root and so on. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That I think is related to the recovery method that Patrick Hayden and others talked about.
Is that published? That work?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I also think. This is related to the recovery map that Daniel Ahmed and I wrote in our appendix using the Schmidt decomposition of the state. The square root of n seems to be fairly reminiscent of a Schmidt coefficient. So I wonder if it's a rewriting of that.
Well, firstly, from this argument, you can construct a matrix for that state representation of your state, which again is kind of very natural in the condensational decomposition. So,
yeah.
If you don't put epsilons, I would guess the answer is yes.
Yeah, there's some other version of this formula with an integral.
The inequality.
Yeah.
The channel is not that channel. Mm-hmm. The channel is modified version is in the digital. Mm-hmm.
That seems like it. Would be nice to understand that formula holography.
So, because you mentioned the Schmidt decomposition, a fun fact about this Petz recovery map is that the rho AB 1/2, rho A minus 1/2 is actually the isometry that relates the pure state with reduced density matrix rho A to the pure state with reduced density matrix rho AB.
You mean for?
It would be like a purification of. Sorry. Yeah, I'm not
not sure I would be able to figure it out. Maybe I should.
I think what you're saying is that if you take a maximum integral state, you can get that prefixion of rho.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So, if you have two different prefixations, different states, then you can do this twice. Well, first, invert the first one, so it's a prefixion of rho, and then you can invert it by being one over one tensor super rho, and then you can multiply it by a different state, and then you get the prefixion of a different state.
Right. I have to find it again. It's basically you get two different pure states that have rho A as the same, or rho reference A as the same reduced states. So you can kind of see this as a isometry relating one to six. Yeah, I'm sorry, I can't recall it like this.
Well,
cookies, coffee, and